21. In the space of a few seconds, with very little help needed from Gideon, it became as obvious to them as it was to him. The placas and tornillos, plates and screws, were clearly visible in the photos of the bared mandible, three narrow, inch-long metal bands, each secured with four screws, which had been inserted to hold together the jaw that had been shattered by Carl Tendler almost 30 years ago. The two fractures themselves were long healed, but the plates and screws remained.
"But wait a minute," Julie said. "Didn't you tell Tony this morning that you'd know if the skull in the museum was Manolo's, because they wouldn't have removed the wiring yet?"
"Right."
"Yet. The implication being that eventually it'd be removed. Well, he was killed only a few months ago. Why is it still there?"
"Oh, this isn't the wiring. The wires would have been between his upper and lower jaws to keep them from moving. They were taken out long ago. If not, he'd have been eating his meals through a straw all these years. No, these plates are put in to keep the pieces in place while they heal, like splints or casts, only on the inside. To remove them would take another operation, two operations. So unless there's a problem, infection, say, they stay in for good."
"Ah, but how come you didn't see this when you looked at the body yourself?"
"Because it was covered with skin, which I wasn't about to try to remove. It took an autopsy to reveal this, and I wasn't doing an autopsy. I was just looking at the thing, helping Flaviano out."
"Well, yes, this is all very interesting," Marmolejo said. "But right now I'm anxious to get started on what happened today." He steepled his fingers at his chin. "I will send a man to the hospital in the event Mr. Gallagher should speak after all. And I will have someone go out to the hacienda this afternoon to conduct interviews. Perhaps I'll go along. It may be that someone can throw light, even inadvertently, on Tony's actions. You know how important it is to gather information quickly, while events are still fresh in everyone's minds."
"Well," Gideon said, taking the hint and gathering himself together, "I guess maybe Julie and I will head over to—"
"And I guess maybe you'll head over to the interrogation room with Corporal Vella, where you'll make a detailed statement as to today's events, while they are still fresh in your mind."
"Of course," Gideon said, "although today's events lasted all of about 2 seconds. Listen, Javier, before we get started on all this, what about this guy, Manolo?" He brandished the file. "He was alive only a few months ago. The statute of limitations doesn't apply. You'll be looking into it, won't you? Besides, there's got to be a connection there to what happened to me, and to all the rest of it."
"Yes, naturally, we'll look into it. However, I think we need a bit more evidence than these placas and tornillos before we conclude that he truly is this Manolo. Other people have had broken jaws."
"Oh, sure. Probably just a coincidence that this particular guy, with a thoroughly healed fractured jaw, a total stranger, was seen wandering up toward the hacienda a few months ago and turned up dead just outside this peaceful, non-murderous little village a few months later. What else could it be but a coincidence?"
He looked up at Marmolejo from under arched eyebrows.
"Yeah, right."
"Yeah, right," Julie concurred. A few seconds passed, and then Marmolejo sighed.
"Yeah, right," he said from the side of his mouth, in a strangled American accent straight out of The Sopranos.
"What sort of place are you looking for?" Marmolejo had inquired, when they'd asked him to recommend a restaurant where they could have lunch in Oaxaca before going to the museum. "Did you want something on the lively side, in the middle of everything, with lots of noise and activity all around, or someplace quieter, more elegant, with real Oaxacan cuisine and ambience, of which few tourists would even be aware?" They had surprised him by choosing the former, and so now they sat at an outdoor table on the arched, porticoed upper story of El Asador Vasco, the largest of the restaurants that bordered the Zocalo, Oaxaca's main plaza. They were glad they'd made the choice. What had happened at Yagul had shaken them both, and it was nice to be in a busy restaurant full of people chatting about normal, everyday things,
and looking down on the green, well-kept public square, lively and bustling. There were strollers on the paths, sunbathers sprawled on the lawns, and sun avoiders in the cool, dense shade of the laurel trees. There were street musicians and vendors of baskets, of balloons, of herbs, of crickets, for eating, of colorful straw masks, of sliced fruits and sweets. A dozen or more of the mobile shoeshine stands with wheels and green awnings were doing a brisk business. At the other end of the plaza, an afternoon band concert was in progress, but only the oompas of the tuba were audible at this distance. Immediately below them was an old man playing the violin, Kreisler, Schubert, Dvorak, with such honeyed sweetness that Gideon had gotten up from the table to go downstairs and place a 50-peso note in his open violin case. It was more than everything else in there put together, and the old man had shown his appreciation by asking what Gideon would like to hear. Gideon had told him that what he was doing was wonderful, and just keep doing it. The old man had taken him at his word. He'd been playing Dvorak's Humoresque at the time, and now, 15 minutes later, he was still playing Humoresque, looking upward to bow to them at the conclusion of each repetition. "I grant you it's a pretty tune," Julie said with a strained smile as he started on his fifth run-through. "But maybe you should go down and give him another 50 pesos and ask him to play something else."
"I most certainly will not," Gideon declared. "I like it, and it seems to be making him happy. If anybody else doesn't like it, they can pay him to change." They were done with their appetizer of manchego cheese with olive oil and toast rounds, and their entrees had just been set down. Sea bass with a grapefruit coulis for Julie, and huge gulf shrimp over garlic-drenched linguine for Gideon. It was after 2 o'clock. Gideon's deposition had consumed more time than expected, and the rich aromas practically had them salivating on the tablecloth. For a few moments, they happily shoveled in the food, only occasionally pausing for a sip of mineral water. Julie suddenly blinked, struck by a thought as obvious as if it had hit her in the forehead. She put down her knife and fork. "That man, the drifter, the mummy, he really is Manolo."
"Oh, I think so. The probability that..."
"No, I just thought of something else. Didn't you say his name was Manuel?"
"Manuel Garcia. At least, that's what he told Sandoval."
"That's what I thought. Well, Manolo isn't really a given name in Spanish. Would you like to guess what it's a nickname for?"
He put down his knife and fork. "Manuel?"
"Exactly. It's got to be the same man, Gideon."
He nodded. "It sure is one more piece that fits. What was Manolo's last name, do you know?"
"If I did, I've forgotten. But they'll know at the hacienda. What do you think the odds are that it's Garcia?"
"Pretty good, I'd say. Sandoval thought it was fake, but now that's looking doubtful."
They finished their meals and sank back, contented over coffee.
"Thank God," Julie exclaimed.
Gideon looked at her. "What?"
"He's finally stopped playing Humoresque. He's on to Mozart now. Eine kleine Nachtmusik."
"You mean you didn't notice?"
"I guess not. I was thinking, if we've now identified Manolo, then what's that skull in the museum?"
Julie shrugged.
"Probably just what it's supposed to be. Some 1,000-year-old Zapotec Indian."
"But why would Tony want to kill me over that?"
"If that's the reason he tried to kill you."
Gideon sighed. "What do you say we head on over to the museum and have a look? Maybe we'll understand more in an hour or two." El Museo de Curiosidades was on Calle Las Casas, only 5 short blocks west of the Zócalo. But in those 5 blocks, Oaxaca went from urban chic to urban grit. Las Casas was a long, narrow, one-way street. If it had been shorter, it would have been an alley, crowded with people and crammed with hole-in-the-wall shops and sidewalk stalls, selling everything from rubber tubing and used automobile batteries to knock-off wristwatches and green high-top sneakers with pictures of Che Guevara or Daffy Duck on them. It was also the route to the second-class bus terminal, so it was choked with diesel fumes
and bumper to bumper with buses so old and beat up that you expected to see them spewing nuts and bolts like cartoon cars. The sidewalks were narrow enough to begin with, and with the encroachment of the curbside stalls, it was impossible to walk without continually shouldering aside people coming the other way, or being shouldered aside by them. Not once, though, did they encounter any rudeness or irritation. The locals had learned to live with it as a matter of course. Every now and then they got separated in the crush, but with Julie being half a foot taller than the average pedestrian, they had no trouble spotting each other over the heads of the crowd. At the intersections, the pedestrian walk signs made them laugh. They were, as Julie remarked, more run signs than walk signs. They allowed 10 seconds to get across the street, and the dwindling seconds were shown. 10, 9, 8. Underneath the numbers was the moving figure of a man. At 10, the start of the countdown, he was sauntering along, but by 5 he had broken into a run, and by 2 he was running like hell, arms and legs churning. The live pedestrians, they noted, did not follow suit. They started at a saunter, and they finished at a saunter, whatever the count. This resulted in an unabated storm of horn honking. The drivers were not as polite as the walkers, which had no effect on the street crossers, but added considerably to the general sense of clamor, closeness, and commotion. They were glad to finally see the museum. It stood on a corner, an old one-story adobe house, much the worse for the 2 centuries or so that it had been in existence, to say nothing of the last 6 or 7 decades of the diesel fumes. Seeing it answered a question that had been bothering Gideon. If the skull was what was worrying Tony, why had he opted for murder rather than going to the museum in the morning when it was closed, finding some way to break in and stealing the skull? Sure, there would have been risks involved, but there had been even more risks doing it the way he did. And whatever the risks, who would choose murder over theft? The answers were on the house itself. There were few windows on the thick walls, and every one of them had not only an iron grill over it, but a steel security shutter, all of which were rolled down. And while the entrance door was probably as old as the building, it had been cross-braced with studded steel bars. A guided missile might have gotten the place open for you, but nothing less. The front of the building was a small courtyard, enclosed by high adobe walls, and secured by a head-high gate of ornate metal grillwork, overpainted so many times that the twining leaves and stems and flowers were hardly more than solid globs of black paint. The heavy old padlock on the gate was in the process of being shaken to make sure it was closed by a small, pale, waspish man in a dark suit and tie. "We're closed," he said to them, in dour, unaccented American English. "You'll have to come back tomorrow." He was a bit of a dandy, or at least he would have been in 1965, when his threadbare double-breasted jacket and inch-wide tie were still in fashion. "You're not open till 4? Julie asked. "No," he said, his voice rising, as if it were something he had already explained to them 12 times. "Tuesdays and Thursdays, 1 until 3. Saturdays, 1 until 5. Mondays, 12 until 3, and Fridays, 12 until 2. Look at the sign," he added irritably, gesturing at a small plaque so darkened by street grime and age that it was next to impossible to read. "But it's barely 3 o'clock now," Gideon said. "Couldn't you let us in just for a minute?"
"Impossible."
"It really is important, and I don't think it'll take long. We'll be glad to pay your admission fees, of course." Now the man was insulted.
"It's not a matter of fees. Standards must be maintained."
"Well, sure, but—"
"I'm sorry. Now really, I must go. I must be on my way. Time is of the essence."
And off he went around the corner, shaking his head. Julie and Gideon looked at each other.
"Now who does he remind me of?" Julie wondered, looking after the scurrying, still muttering figure.
"Alice in Wonderland?" Gideon guessed. "The Mad Hatter?" They both laughed.
"You might be right," she said. "Well, what now?"
"I come back tomorrow, I guess.
between 12 and 3. Standards must be maintained.
No, I meant us. What do you want to do right now? Do you...
The phone in her bag went off, and she dug it out. They both went to stand right up against the wall of the building, out of the central flow of foot traffic, which until then had been parting around them and then coming together again, the way a stream does around a boulder.
Oh, hello, Javier,
she began brightly, then quickly sobered.
Oh, did he say anything before?
Okay, I see.
Yes, I appreciate that.
Yes, of course, I'll tell him.
Thanks, Javier.
Tony's dead, Gideon said as she put away the phone.
Yes, he never regained consciousness.
He stopped speaking and shook his head.
Julie looked hard at him.
Gideon, you have nothing to blame yourself for. What else could you do?
I know that, Julie. It's just that...
But it was hard to sort out his feelings, let alone to put them into words. Of course, Tony's death was Tony's own doing. Of course, it was inadvertent on Gideon's part. It had just happened, and Tony alone was to blame. Still, there was no avoiding the simple fact that Tony Gallagher, alive yesterday, was dead today. He would be mourned and missed by his family. And the unavoidable truth was that if Gideon Oliver had never gone to Oaxaca, he would still be alive. She squeezed his hand.
It was not your fault, she said firmly. And the others aren't going to blame you, believe me.
He nodded. I hope not.
One more shake of his head, this time to clear it.
I wonder if we'll ever find out what it was all about now, Julie said.
Pretty doubtful. Javier's probably going to drop the whole thing now. From a legal point of view, there's nothing to be done. Tony's dead. There's nobody to be prosecuted.
No, he's going to keep pursuing it. He made a point of telling me so, and he wanted me to make sure you knew.
I'm glad to hear it. I guess he's gotten intrigued, and he needs to know how all the strands of this thing fit together. That sounds more like the old Marmolejo. None of this statute of limitations baloney.
She nodded.
Anyway, back to what we do now. You want to head on back to the hacienda?
Well, if you want to.
But you don't?
Not really, no. Marmolejo's people are probably out there talking to them right now, so everything's probably in an uproar. And they're going to be in a state of shock about Tony, that he's dead, and how he died. They'll have a million questions. I just don't feel up to facing that right now.
Okay, I can understand that. Why don't we do some sightseeing and then have dinner here by ourselves? Then you won't have to face them until tomorrow, when it's all sunk in. And we can give ourselves a pleasant afternoon. I'd say we've earned it, especially you.
Sounds like a plan, Gideon agreed. They threaded their way through the swarms. All the foot traffic seemed to be against them, as workers apparently headed for the bus terminal for transportation out to their villages. Back to the Zocalo, bought themselves a guide pamphlet. There wasn't anything that could properly be called a guidebook at one of the stalls, and spent the next 4 hours seeing the sights. The grand old Palacio del Gobierno, now a museum, the cathedral, the museum of pre-Hispanic art. When that wore them down, they returned to the now empty Zocalo to drink coffee at an outdoor cafe and watch the sinking sun burnish the tops of the laurels and the arched porticos of the surrounding buildings. Then they walked a couple of blocks to El Naranjo, the other restaurant that Marmolejo had recommended in the event they wanted. Someplace quieter, more elegant, with real Oaxacan cuisine and ambience, of which few tourists would even be aware. The place lived up to advance billing. A cool, quiet, sky-lighted interior courtyard in a well-kept colonial building, with Moorish arches, a 17th-century floor of greenstone tiles, and a trickling stone fountain, and a full-sized orange tree, El Naranjo, in the middle. They ate chicken with mole coloradito, drank local beer, and never once talked about murder or skulls or Tony Gallagher and his clan.